Hi, folks. Denise Howell here, and you're about to enjoy This Week in Law with me, Matt Curtis, and Bill Donahue, who co-hosts the Pro Se podcast over at Law 360 and is a senior reporter there. We're going to talk about Star Trek Discovery, business models, piracy, influences, and much more. Twitter goes long, but what are the implications for the copyrightability of tweets? We're going to talk about the moral prerogatives of a broke law student, our first ever fan-made animal selfie, green eggs and tribbles, and much more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Matt Curtis, Mike Keyes, and Emery Roan. Episode 401, recorded September 29th, 2017. Waymo Bucks. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Felix Gray. Give your eyes the break they deserve with Felix Gray glasses. Their lenses filter blue light and eliminate glare from screens without the telltale yellow tint or color distortion of other computer glasses. Go to felixgrayglasses.com/twill to try a pair today. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. We're so glad you're here with us this week. We have an excellent, excellent guest, and one of my fabulous co-hosts is joining us this week. Bill Donahue is our guest. He is the senior reporter at Law 360, and his beat is intellectual property law. Hi, Bill. Great to meet you.
Hi, Denise. Thanks for having me.
So, Bill, you show up in my email inbox all the time from Law 360. We introduced people to Law 360 if they weren't already familiar with it when Amber McKinney was on the show recently. But just to recap for anybody who missed Amber's show, Law 360 is the news arm of LexisNexis, and LexisNexis is one of the huge research tools used in the legal profession. So it's really cool that LexisNexis decided to become a media outlet in its own right. And that's where you've been employed for some time, correct?
That's right. I've been there for about, I guess about 5 years now. So it's getting on there. But yeah, that's what we do. We try to keep everybody up to date on anything that's happening in the legal industry.
That's neat. And are you a lawyer yourself?
I'm not. No, I approached this from the journalism background and sort of learned the law as I went along. It was sort of, it was challenging at first, but now I've been covering this area for so long that I feel like I know the ins and outs.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. If you were to go to law school and or take the bar, it would probably be a pretty easy road for you. Also here is Matt Curtis. Matt is a law student at Notre Dame. And co-host here on the show. Wonderful to see you again, Matt.
Yeah, great to see you too, and great to have Bill on. It's good to. I also get the emails in my mailbox, and I was not aware that he wasn't a lawyer, so he fooled me.
That's right.
That's what we try.
I'm not a lawyer, but I play one on the internet. How about that?
Sure.
Matt, why don't you tell people a big weekend at Notre Dame? What's going on tomorrow night?
Oh, yeah. We have tomorrow in the courtroom, we have the Slants, who we had earlier on the show, coming in, and they're going to give a show and give a talk about their experience of going to the Supreme Court earlier this year. This all happened thanks to my involvement on the show. So my evergreen thanks to Denise and having me involved is now making me the cool kid on campus. So everyone's excited to have them in, and it'll be great to meet them in person.
I so wish I could go. They, as far as I can tell from Simon and the band's Twitter feeds, they're sort of making a law school victory round tour in the wake of their Supreme Court victory. They've been playing in a lot of places around the country. And the universal response from lawyers who get to attend these things is, so, you know, they're giving a talk about their victory, wonderful free speech victory, where they were able to register their trademark and a portion of the Lanham Act was determined to be unconstitutional as the result of their claims. Wonderful result for them, and they're a great band. So people have been coming around to hear about their case, and they're getting MCLE credit and getting great rock and roll entertainment too. So it's a win-win situation. I'm hoping to catch them if they swing through Southern California one of these days. It would be great to see them live. Bill, were you following that case pretty closely as well?
That case was pretty much my whole life for a while there. But it is so funny that everyone assumed that it would be the Redskins to take this case up to the Supreme Court, and the fact that it was this little band from Portland, it added a really interesting element to an already very interesting story.
Right. Well, hopefully you can catch them live too at some point.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so.
How far are you from Notre Dame?
Quite far. I'm in Brooklyn. So,
you're Brooklyn. Well, you could go to the show and then have no sleep on your way back home.
Yeah.
That would work well. Yes. I love that they're playing in the courtroom too. That's going to really just be oh so appropriate.
And, yeah. I'll send you a short clip of it.
Yeah, please do. Please do. All right. Well, we are going to jump right into our stories of the week. And since we're talking about music and entertainment at the top of the show here, let's just continue on in that vein. So we don't get to lead with monkey selfies this week, unfortunately, but we get to lead with one of my most favorite things in lieu of monkey selfies, and that is Star Trek. We have a couple of reasons to talk about Star Trek this week. Of course, Star Trek Discovery came out, I guess it was, a week ago Sunday now, and aired on the CBS network. But if you haven't been paying close attention to all of this, you may not be familiar with the fact that CBS is experimenting with the distribution of its new Star Trek series. It aired on broadcast television to, enable people to see the first episode, the pilot. But if you want more, you have to sign up for CBS All Access, which is CBS's streaming service. And All Access is the paid version of CBS's streaming service. I think they have a free tier as well. But to see Discovery and, anything other than the first episode, and huge caveat, if you'd like to see it in a legal manner without pirating the show, you need to sign up for CBS All Access, and the price of it varies whether you're willing to tolerate commercials or not. You can I think it's $6.99 if you are a commercial friendly person, $9.99 if you want to eliminate those from your viewing experience, and that's per month. Star Trek fans have been, busily pirating the show if they didn't want to sign up for CBS All Access. I'm sure that that's something that CBS must have thought about beforehand, but it is an interesting business trade-off that they've decided to make there. Will the fees that we make for the legal service offset the pirating? And taking it off broadcast just seems like something that they're trying out to see how that model works for them. So I think it's super interesting for all of those reasons. Also, just to throw into this discussion, this is not the only great show that's out there that, and by the way, I've seen it and I'm hooked. I've seen episode one and two. We ponied up for CBS All Access to be able to watch it. But I will say that our family is probably in the same boat as the people that were the subject of this story in the Washington Post that is headlined, "Meet the Sometime Streamer, TV Watchers Who Sign Up for One Show, Then Cancel." I know that I did this with Hulu for The Handmaid's Tale. Definitely wanted to see The Handmaid's Tale, but you know, everything else on Hulu is just sort of meh to me. So once I was done binge watching that, I quickly put that subscription on hold so that we would not be charged for it. I know that people do this with HBO, and that there are plenty of people out there thinking that their HBO subscription is not necessary for them until Game of Thrones comes back, whenever it does. And so, you know, something else that CBS is going to have to factor in here is that the customers that they bring in through this experiment that they're doing may not be terribly loyal. And from the Washington Post piece that we have in our discussion points for the show, and you could see everything that we've reviewed to prep for the show today at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. This is episode 401. From that piece, it talks about the percentages of cancellations and how long people may keep these services. There's a gentleman named Glenn Hauer who's quoted there. He's a senior analyst at the market research firm Parks and Associates. He says, although just 1% of cancellations are by viewers discontinuing a free trial, many people appear to be spending a matter of months on a streaming service before switching. The churn numbers tend to be pretty high, indicating there are a substantial number of consumers subscribing to a service for a short time and then bailing out, Hauer said. So Netflix gets people for longer periods of time, probably just because they have just such a vast amount of material, an average of 3 to 5 years, according to Glenn Hauer and his firm. But others, streaming services, manage to hang on to customers for little more than a year. So interesting things going on in the broadcast world. Definitely a new frontier, not to make a bad Star Trek pun, as far as how things are getting distributed and how piracy plays into all of that. As far as piracy of Star Trek Discovery goes, it was way up there on Pirate Bay's list of most pirated videos. The first episode was the 12th most actively pirated show on September 26th when Ars Technica wrote this up. And the second episode wasn't far behind at number 19. So, Bill, do you find all this fascinating?
I do. I mean, it's. I think you mentioned the trade-off. You know, that putting this on an online platform, sort of the calculated risk of doing it. And I think it sort of speaks to what we've seen over the last 20 years in the media industry. That you know, it's sort of been, if you can't beat them, join them. That. You know, folks are gonna pirate this, but by not offering a service like this, you are sort of cutting yourself off from that market. That the folks are gonna take. I think there's a certain futility to trying to stop piracy. Not that they shouldn't stop it, but and I think you see this in things that are pirated a lot. You know, Game of Thrones is pirated a lot. Which I think we may have mentioned, and HBO was another pioneer with HBO Go and VOD digital sort of platforms. So it's interesting to see how the two really go hand in hand a lot of the time.
Matt, do you think it's interesting that there's a commercial free version of this at a higher tier? I wonder if this is CBS playing with the model of, you know, if we go the way of HBO and just charge enough money, we don't need no stinking commercials.
Yeah, I think that it's really hard for CBS because they've got to get, you know, they've got to keep their users who are used to a cable service. So some of their older customers, you know, they're cutting some of them out from their content. And so offering them a more traditional view online is kind of hedging their bets. I think it'll be really interesting to see how this model works out. And because this isn't a dynamic that Amazon Prime or Hulu or Netflix has when they're creative content. Like, so active users that are paying for CBS, you know, they're going to feel like they're not getting their full service through their cable now, where that's a brand split, which other companies don't have to deal with. So I'd be interested to see how this goes and how companies, you know, other big brands that have relied on cable are going to try to split this. Whether they choose to partner with companies like Netflix or whether they try to create an independent service. I know that I fit into the 1%. I fully intend to wait until all of the episodes are on there and then get a free trial and binge watch it. I think that's one of the moral prerogatives of being a broke law student is that you'd feel justified in doing that. I think anybody
should feel justified in doing that.
Yeah.
Alone.
So, it'll be interesting to watch. I think it's pretty clear that everyone would rather be in Netflix's shoes in terms of like just vertically integrating customers into one branch rather than trying to move them from one to another in a long and arduous process.
I just think it's fascinating to watch the entertainment industry continue, you know, we've been doing this show for almost 11 years now, continue to sort of flounder through how do we deal with the online world? How do we use it? How do we combat it when it is detrimental to our business? And this is just the latest example of that. And I say floundering because I think CBS has shot itself in the foot a couple of ways here. As Virgil in IRC is pointing out, by limiting availability, they're basically just inviting piracy. I mean, I'm sure that they would have built that into their calculations, however they distributed the show, but they've got to up the anticipated piracy numbers by making this particular choice. The other thing I think is really interesting is, okay, we're going to go the streaming model. They're actually partnered with Netflix in distributing the show. Netflix is their distributor if you're not in the U.S. But they didn't follow the Netflix model of, you know, Orange is the New Black comes out or Breaking Bad comes out and you've got all the episodes at once, like Matt was saying, and you can binge watch. Well, they're still following the traditional TV model where they're releasing the new episodes at a particular time on a particular day, and they'll continue doing that until the season is over. Bill, can you think of any reason why they haven't taken the full plunge into the Netflix type model?
I wouldn't say that the Netflix model, that there's a consensus that the Netflix model is something that that everyone enjoys. I think there is something to be said about the pageantry of the week to week watching that people get out of Game of Thrones and the AMC shows and everything that still is on that traditional track. So I think there's adherence to both, and it seems for now CBS is trying to stick to the original one.
And the other thing we should mention is just an unintended beneficiary of this decision and decisions like this, I think, is Roku and services like it. Because Star Trek fans in the U.S. who want to watch this show and don't just want to watch it on their phone or tablet or computer screen, but the place where they're used to watching TV, wherever that might be, need a set-top box to do that. So Roku just did its IPO and the stock went skyrocketing. I won't say that this is a contributing factor, but it's certainly in the mix of why I think Roku and things like it are something that people need in their lives if media companies continue to go this way with the way they're releasing things. Matt, any more thoughts on the business model here?
Yeah, just I have a question for both of you. Are we still surprised that the cable box is still like a thing? That this isn't like, you know, as we talk about this, like, isn't it just kind of amazing that this business has like stuck around long past its sell-by date?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was going to be my question here. That the real thing to watch, and I think in the next few years, is what transformations come to the traditional pay TV model. That you know. Everyone always put this, you know, if ESPN starts dropping in value, there's these various sort of tipping points for the traditional, you know, where the cord cutting tipping point is, as we get closer to that, it'll be really interesting to see what they do. I mean, do they entrench? Do they try to lock people in for more? Do they keep doing the thing where they where you call them to cancel and they'll throw all these different things at you? Do they fundamentally change? It's an interesting thing to watch in the next couple of years.
Yeah, and right now we're stuck in that space where I think a lot of people feel like they still need to pay for cable to get all the or satellite to get all the programming that they want. And yet you have all these additional streaming services vying for your time, money, and attention. I don't know anybody who's happy with the amount of their cable or satellite bill, but as we move toward the new model, you may get to customize more of what you want, but it's kind of meet the new boss, same as the old boss. You're probably going to be paying a similar amount as you're subscribing to all these different services, even if you completely cut the cord and don't keep your cable or satellite service. I'm guessing your bills, if you tally them all up, are probably comparable. But one interesting thing is the ISPs that are partnering up and offering, I forget which one offers you Netflix and which one offers you HBO with your service, but those two things are available from T-Mobile and maybe it's AT&T. So that's an interesting twist, that some of that expense where you might go out and as you're a la carte designing your media diet, some of it might be built into what you're paying to actually receive, whether it's cellular service or internet service at home. So fascinating, all of it. Any final thoughts on this bill?
No, I mean, other than when we start talking about, you know, I haven't really seen the situation that you were talking about with cable providers offering various services, but just the, I'm not sure, maybe we'll get to it later in the show, but that immediately made me think of net neutrality concerns and competition mm-hmm. concerns that, you know, when you start saying that you can get, you know, Netflix has struck a deal with Comcast to get Comcast subscribers a cheaper rate for Netflix. It raises all sorts of other really tricky questions.
It does indeed. But before you, we're not going to get to those tricky questions right away because we have more to discuss about Star Trek Discovery. Yeah. One of the things that we enjoyed following along while it was still being litigated was the Axanar litigation, which involved use of the Klingon language as one of the claims that CBS and Paramount were alleging one of the copyrighted elements of the what would have been the full-length feature film, Axanar. And Axanar has since complied with the guidelines that CBS and Paramount put out while their litigation was pending, and the parties have settled their case. But if you've watched Star Trek Discovery, or if you haven't, one thing I can tell you without spoiling the new show is heavy, heavy usage of the Klingon language, to the point where a lot of the dialogue is subtitled. And just as an aside, if you are one of those people outside the U.S. who are enjoying the show via Netflix, one of the translation options, subtitle options for you as you're queuing up the show and getting ready to watch, if you'd like to see all the English portions translated into Klingon, that's an option available for you. So the Klingon language is definitely a big part of this series, which is fascinating in light of the claims made in Axanar and all of the history of the Klingon language that came out there, in that a very sort of basic Klingon grammar was commissioned by CBS and Paramount for one of the movies, but then the language took on a life of its own in the hands of the fans after that. And it seems that CBS and Paramount has adopted the language in, you know, its fulsome current iteration in the new show. So I found that fascinating and wondered if you guys thought so too. Oh, the other, before we I find your takes on the Klingon language, the other thing that ties in with Axanar is the folks at Axanar, of course, are watching Star Trek Discovery closely and have noted in their review of the new show, not that they're, you know, saber rattling at all or being bitter about this at all, but they do find the new show pretty similar to what they were doing in Axanar, that they feel like they definitely influenced the course of the new show. They write, being that Discovery was developed after Prelude to Axanar, their trailer for the Axanar film, they wonder how much of an influence their work was on the new show. But it doesn't sound like they're getting all litigious on that front. So, Bill, any thoughts?
Well, it's an interesting point that that they see similarities in Discovery from what they were putting together, because, as you know, the Axanar case was a fair use case. And one of the key questions when it comes to fair use is whether or not you are replacing something that the original user was doing. So it's not a fact pattern you see too often, the idea of the copyright owner later developing something to fill that thing to make a legal argument. I don't want to speculate as to why those similarities exist, but it definitely would be an interesting thing from a fair use perspective if you were Axanar and had been, you know, sued and made this fair use argument that they made.
Right. Matt, what do you think of all this?
Yeah, I want to set up a VPN so that I can get subtitles in Klingon. Like, I'm just so disappointed that we don't have this in my network as I'm doing the week free trial to watch all their shows for free. Yeah, I think that I do think it's kind of interesting the not that they were complaining that Star Trek was taking content from them or anything like that. But that is the problem with fan films, right? And so if you're doing an offshoot fan film that, you know, you make this great work and everyone really likes it, you're not going to have, you know, you're not going to have any rights to the content, or I guess not that you're not going to have any rights. You may have rights to some of the characters that you've created in the world. But the idea that the main brand who's making that might be in litigation over a character in their world that they created, that would make me as a major content creator not want to allow fan films. And so, you know, hopefully that both parties just let this lie and enjoy each other's content.
Right. It would make for a super interesting law school exam question. Professor friends out there, take note.
Don't put that on mine.
That's except a tough for yours.
One. I don't want it.
You're already studying for it now. It's not a big deal.
Yeah.
If Axanar were to do something about this, but again, it doesn't sound like they will. There's probably not something terribly concrete that they could do something about here. But, you know, just to riff on what you're saying, Matt, I think, you know, if you are successfully invoking the fair use doctrine and have hit all the ticked all the boxes that let you do that, and you create something new that has its own, you know, it's borrowing from something in the past, but it has its own unique story and characters and things, I think, you know, they, of course, that new creative work is copyrightable, as creative works are. And then, you know, to go after the hand that fed you would be a fairly interesting choice to make. I don't think they're going to do that, but fun to think about. All right. Also fun to think about, always fun to think about, is Taylor Swift. But I don't quite understand, and maybe you can help us understand, Bill, what's going on. A couple of years ago, I remember that she was sued over lyrics in Shake It Off, Playa's Gonna Play, Haters Gonna Hate.
Yeah.
But that went away, and now she's being sued again. Do you know what's happening?
So the new suit, I believe, is over, and where are the lyrics? I had them in front of me. I would be remiss to mention to talk about this at all just at the outset without mentioning that in that previous case, the lawsuit was tossed out with an incredibly well-written opinion that extensively quoted from Taylor Swift. saying that the court is not saying that Brahm can never, ever get back into court and things of that nature. So, the new case is over that, you know, that they had these general similarities to Playas and Haters and things like that. And that, you know, that this sequence created by the plaintiffs was unique and copyrightable. It's part of a big trend that I've been seeing. And, you know, I wrote a story earlier this year about it for Law 360 about the boom in these kind of lawsuits, these music lawsuits against, you know, sort of coming out of the woodwork kind of cases against big stars. And a lot of experts in the industry see it as an outgrowth of the Blurred Lines verdict a couple of years ago, that was sort of a it was this huge incentive to people to file cases like this. You know, here was this song that made X million dollars, and we see some similarities, and it's worthwhile to file a lawsuit and see where it goes, see if we get a settlement out of it, see if they pay us to go away. So this is part of a trend that we're seeing a lot more of these music lawsuits where someone claims that the core of their song was taken and used in a later song.
It seems weird to me. I'm a little bit different from Blurred Lines and other cases like it, in that we're not talking about musical similarities. And if we had Mike on the show, that's really something he loves to sink his teeth into and get into, whether the chord progressions and rhythms, et cetera, are being copied. But here we're talking about lyrics. Do you think there's a harder case to make if you're talking about a short lyric that someone has perhaps adopted or just has something that sounds similar?
Yeah, I mean, they claim that their lyric was "Play is gonna play," and as we know, that's a key part of the Taylor Swift song. That being said, it's hard to I think you'd have a good argument that "Players are gonna play" is not the most original idea. And that it's this short little piece. So I think that clearly, like you said, when it comes to lyrics, it's very different than when we're talking about chord progressions and things like that. But in this particular case, it seems like the plaintiffs will still have an uphill climb.
All right. Well, I don't know how we don't make "Playa's Gonna Play" our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We put these phrases into the show in case you are someone who chooses to apply in your jurisdiction to receive MCLE credit for watching or listening to the show. We are not ourselves an approved provider in any of the 50 states or U.S. territories, but we certainly encourage you, if you want to take a flyer on getting credit in your jurisdiction. We have a chart up that is at wiki.twit.tv that hopefully will provide you some help if you've never asked for credit from something that comes from a non-approved provider before. Hopefully it will give you some information about what part of your bar and what forms you might need to submit to do that. And also, it's not just lawyers. As I understand it, some people in other professions have continuing education requirements too that this show may help them out with. So we put these phrases in case you need to demonstrate that you actually watched or listened to the show. First one is "Play is Gonna Play" for this episode 401. And we'll put another one in at some point later on in the show. And talking about things that are not terribly original, let's go right into our trademark discussion, shall we? We have a couple of great genericide stories in the lineup for this week. So let's start with the one with the funny lawyer video, shall we? This is hysterical. Bill, I'm assuming you put this in the rundown, and I'm so glad you did. I hadn't seen this yet. But Velcro is among the companies out there that wishes that you wouldn't call every single product Velcro that includes products that they themselves did not make. They would vastly prefer that you use a more generic term and not their brand name of Velcro to describe hook and loop fastening technologies and mechanisms. And much like the Netflix lawyers that we talked about last week, they have made the legal profession look pretty darn fun and relatable by putting out this video, and we're just going to play you some here. You think it's awesome for us, we're famous, but we're lawyers and it's causing us grief. Cause there are trademark laws being broken, it's all here in this short legal brief. And we know that this is confusing, because Velcro brand is who we are. What if you called all Velcro? We're gonna lose our circle R. This is called we're gonna lose our circle R. You call it Velcro, but we're letting you. This is f***ing hook and loop. I just love this thing. Bravo, Velcro. Bravo. Well played.
Yes, well done.
So their message is, you know, please, and they go on to talk about Clorox bleach and what did they say? Inline skating versus rollerblading. Very many other companies who have had their successful product name become the name of everything in the industry. And they don't want that to happen to them. Bill, my question for you, as someone who writes a lot about trademark law, should we be thinking about a change in the law here so that companies don't have to do this? Shouldn't they be able to keep their trademark even if their brand is so successful that every hook and loop fastening system is referred to commonly as Velcro?
Well, it's a hard question because, right, and I think that the court cases that have dealt with genericide, they acknowledge that it's a really difficult situation because it's essentially punishing a company that's been so successful that they're losing their trademark. But at the same time, the policy function of genericide is that you don't want a company locking up terms that are ubiquitous, that are you know, part of the lexicon. It's a safety valve almost for trademark law, because trademark law does limit speech. It's in tension with the First Amendment. So, you know, sure, it is unfortunate if you are Thermos and you were so successful at selling vacuum sealed cooling tubes or whatever the generic term they would have preferred was, that's unfortunate for you. But it shouldn't, if that's the way that the public has come to view your term, I think it's an appropriate limitation on trademark law's restrictions on speech.
Yeah, I think it's a really tough issue. I really think that companies should be able to keep their trademarks and not be victimized by their own successes. But there are good reasons, I suppose, to just try and fight against the generatization of your brand. Matt, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't know what the origin of the law, and I have not read the cases, but just from an equity standpoint, I'm not sure, like, you know, Bill mentions that this is in conflict with free speech. Well, most of copyright is in conflict with, like, a pure free speech. And the question isn't, like, can I stop a consumer from calling a non-Velcro branded hook and ladder or something Velcro? It's whether the company that's in competition with them can say on their branding that this is Velcro. And to me, it doesn't seem like bad for consumer welfare in like an abstract perspective that like another company can't call, you know, like another company is making this sort of thing, can't call what they're calling it Velcro. I don't see why that particularly matters. It, you know, for consumers who aren't going to buy it, because it's not called Velcro, even though it does the same thing. You know, maybe there's a pricing differentiation, but I would imagine that it's going to equal out. I, once again, I've not read the cases on this, but it seems to me that there's not you know, this isn't the First Amendment where we're talking about speech on politics or speech on anything else. This is where a company has you know, made up a name of something and want to be the only people to call their product that. And that doesn't seem unconstitutional to me. But
right. I think the argument would be that when it has reached this point where that we call genericide, that other companies for competitive purposes have a right to use a term that, you know, the question when it comes to genericism is whether it's understood by the relevant public primarily to refer to a genus of goods. So it's not like this is a step that you take lightly. It's not like most brands are being victimized by this. It's a situation where you truly are claiming ownership over a name that competing companies need to use to compete with you. So I think we need to shy away from the idea that this is, you know, that this is victimizing brands it's taking away people's trademark rights willy-nilly. I think it's mm-hmm. a very, very sort of nuclear option for a court to rule that a brand that once had the distinctiveness that required the source designating power of a trademark has lost it. I don't think that's a step that courts take lightly. So I don't think it's, you know, I don't think it's something I don't think it's a pressing problem.
Right? Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like paying high taxes. Like, yeah, you have to pay higher taxes, but that means you're making more money. And in the same vein, like, yeah, your trademark's being taken away, but that's because you did that. I think the origin question is whether, you know, what is the purpose of trademark? And if the purpose of trademark is for consumers to be able to differentiate between products on the basis of who's making them, then you're not taking it away from the company. You're taking away the differentiation from the consumer. Now, I don't think that there's a whole lot of, like, you know, I don't think anyone's a quote-unquote victim in this situation. You know, they would be losing a property right, but they've dominated the market to such an extent that that's a real consideration. I don't think this is, like, hurting companies. You know, this isn't hurting innovation. This isn't hurting these kind of things. So I'm not overly worried about this. I agree with that. But I do think it's an interesting question about what it does to the market and if there's any analysis about, you know, does competition actually increase when you take away the trademark? Does pricing come down? And if it doesn't, then what's the point?
Okay. On a similar note, there is an argument being made in litigation pending in California. There will be a trial on these issues since a summary judgment just this last week did not wind up resolving all the issues in the case. It has to do with Comic-Con, San Diego Comic-Con, who thinks that they have the trademark and should be having the exclusive use of the term Comic-Con. However, as we know, lots of other Comic-Cons exist and use that term. Their opponent in the case is the Salt Lake City Comic-Con, but as the judge noted in deciding whether or not the case could go to trial on the issue of whether this mark had become generic, there is evidence in this case of over 100 competitors using the unhyphenated form of San Diego Comic-Con's trademark, which strongly suggests that it may have become generic. What are your thoughts here, Bill?
So the interesting distinction between this and Velcro is that Velcro started as, in the trademark parlance, as an arbitrary term, which is a very strong form of trademark, right? It didn't have anything in plain language that connected the word Velcro to Hook and Loop, the product that it was doing. Comic-Con, on the other hand, it begins as a very descriptive term. It is a comic convention. So even before you get into the idea of, you know, third-party use or the way that consumers understand this term, it starts as a much less distinctive, a much weaker trademark at the very outset. So that that places it sort of at a different posture than something like Velcro, where when it started, it was this arbitrary strong brand name that meant something. And now we're arguing that it's lost that from ubiquitousness. This is something where it starts as a pretty non-distinctive thing. And they could claim that they built up this distinctiveness in their own, you know, their own version of the Comic-Con, but I think it's a harder situation for them to I think it's a harder set of facts.
Right. Just as a random, my brain is wandering aside. last week, one of our tips of the week was that robots are molecular. I wonder if Velcro is going down to the nano level to fasten things together that need to be fastened and are very, very small. Sorry to just drop that into the show. Matt, anything you want to say about Comic-Con?
I'm really hoping that they make a video just like Velcro did, first of all. And then, I think that Bill's analysis, this is really good in that it's kind of like how strong is their trademark from the beginning. I think I read in the articles that there was previous use of that name, although they didn't build it into a brand of sort of a Comic-Con. But I do personally, I've never gone to a Comic-Con convention of any sort, but I do think of it as the Comic-Con in San Diego. So, but I'm not really a consumer in the relevant field. So, but that's just an aside.
We're working on you, Matt.
I'm trying.
Yeah.
I've been to a manga convention. You know, that checks a box.
Yeah. Absolutely, it does. Bill, I think, again, maybe you put this in the rundown, and it's a fascinating little tidbit for people who are following every breath and word that is uttered in the dispute between Waymo and Uber, because some very interesting things are coming out of that dispute. One interesting thing noted in, I guess, papers filed by the parties describing damages is that merely one of the trade secrets asserted in the case is valued at $2.6 billion. And there are several trade secrets asserted as having been misappropriated by Uber. So fascinating little tidbit dribbling out. They've been pretty mum about what their damages might be, but this is a good clue that they're going to be in some high numbers. Is this perhaps the highest valuation on a trade secret to date, Bill? What's your guess on that?
I wouldn't want to speculate on other cases. I'm not exactly sure what the highest number is, but it's an exceptionally high number, particularly coming from one trade secret when the guy at the middle of this case, Anthony Lewandowski, the Waymo engineer who founded his own company and then the company was bought up by Uber, he is alleged to have taken 14,000 documents with him when he left Waymo. So I don't want to extrapolate and say how many trade secrets might be involved, but if one is worth $2.6 billion, a very, very, very big and important case just got a whole lot bigger.
Right. Can I just drop into the show another little rabbit hole here that has nothing to do with the dispute between Waymo and Uber, but does have to do with Anthony Lewandowski, who apparently has started a religion where AI is the godhead. It's called Way of the Future. And it is anticipating that people may want to have a religious organization that aims to develop and promote the realization of a godhead based on artificial intelligence. So straight out of William Gibson, if you ask me, but this is a real thing. So bots are molecular, Velcro could be, and AI is a religion or a godhead, just so you know.
Matt, well, he was laid off from Uber as a result of this litigation. So I guess he has a lot of free time on his hands to be setting up religions. So we'll see.
We'll see. He still has to file the appropriate documents with the IRS if he wants to make this a thing. I'm just hoping that there's spaghetti involved in one way or another. Matt, what do you think about the valuation of that particular trade secret?
Yeah, I was not personally shocked that the valuation is that high. Now, we don't know what specific trade secret it is, but if we're talking about like the LiDAR technology that's going to enable a company that's going to enable Google to run its self-driving cars, I don't think it's that inconceivable that this is a $2.3 billion market. Especially when you talk about the value of a trade secret, you're talking about the long-term value of this. And so the distinction between trade secrets and patents and the way the industries tend to align is that trade secrets tend to be tools and items that are non-self-disclosing. So when you put them out in the market, you're not able to figure out how they work. The question is whether LiDAR technology or these kind of technologies are non-self-disclosing, and therefore they could be trade secrets and continue indefinitely. Whereas patents, you have to disclose the invention, and these tend to be things that are either industry-specific or you could reverse engineer or some combination of factors. But you're talking about self-driving cars potentially into a infinite time horizon. We look at the industries that have this right now, the confectionery industry, Butterfinger, all of these, Oreos, they're not patented. And these companies have been able to keep their trade secrets for 100 years. Coca-Cola isn't patented. It's a trade secret to it. There's only a handful of people in the world who know the recipe. And the value of that to those companies, I got to imagine that the value of the Coca-Cola trade secret would be more. We're talking about the future of automation. We're talking about not only – you're talking about the valuation of Uber and the valuation of GM. So, I'm not surprised.
All right. Well, I think we're going to move on to some copyright stories before we let Bill Donahue get out of here. So let's work in. We already talked about Star Trek a bit. We can do it again. And you'll see why, because we're going to talk about the Grinch and fair use. So, Bill, you have an article up at Law 360 about a play in New York called Whose Holiday that riffed on the Dr. Seuss classic How the Grinch Stole Christmas. And the folks who hold the rights to Dr. Seuss's works were not happy about it and sued. But lo and behold, the show must go on, apparently, because the fair use doctrine protected them here. Can you tell us more about this?
Yeah. So it was a sort of an adult themed sort of dark riff on Cindy Lou Who 20 years after the events of How the Grinch Stole Christmas. And, the playwright Matthew Lombardo claimed that it was a parody, that he was criticizing the sort of the naivete of the Seuss universe, that the messages that were coming out of Grinch about this utopian world and everything else, he was trying to sort of criticize those. The estate obviously saw things very differently. They said this is an unauthorized sequel to our works that it's this that it's a derivative work. It's something that's clearly covered by copyright. So I think it was 2 weeks ago, the judge came down very definitively for Lombardo, ruling that it was in fact parody, which is one of the sort of paradigmatic fair uses under the fair use doctrine.
So the way that Star Trek comes into this is, for folks who've been listening to the show, regularly listen to the show, you know that we've talked about the copyright infringement and trademark infringement suit that is still pending between the Dr. Seuss rights holders. And here, the authors of a book called Oh, the Places You'll Boldly Go, which is a Star Trek Seuss mashup and a riff on Oh, the Places You'll Go, the Dr. Seuss book, that we keep finding in various locations. I've seen it for sale at Urban Outfitters. Matt, you saw it for sale in an airport recently, right?
Yeah, it was at O'Hare, and it was just good to see.
Right. Oh, the Places You'll Go is still living on. You might remember it as one of the many Dr. Seuss books you probably read or found in the library when you were a little kid. But apparently today people are giving it to their graduates as they move on in life. So it continues to have book sales and a life of its own. And apparently the Seuss folks are concerned that Oh, the Places You'll Boldly Go might interfere with their continuing book sales. And the fair use issue in that case is still alive. And you can read all about that in Seussian verse, if you recall, or if you'd like, in a post by Michael Keyes, our other co-host here, who couldn't be with us this week, at his blog, thetmca.com, Fair Use on the Loose for the Great Dr. Seuss, one of my favorite blog posts of all time, if you must know.
Yeah.
So in that case, we're not sure if fair use is going to carry the day or not. I'm not sure if their parody arguments are probably as strong or quite the same as what was asserted on behalf of this play in New York. But we'll see, because that has yet to go to trial. Bill, have you been following that one as well?
I have, yeah. There was, I think there was a ruling this summer, I believe in July, finding that the judge said that, you know, that it's too close a call on these fair use factors to come down one way or the other. Right. I think the judge said that it was a near perfect balance, and that she couldn't grant she needed more details before she ruled on fair use. But she did say that that the work was transformative, which is she didn't say that it was parody, which is sort of in the same area of the fair use analysis. But she did say that it was transformative, which is a big push in the right direction toward a finding that it is fair use. There are other considerations, and it's a balancing act, and they're all non-exclusive. So, you know, the judge could eventually find that this book had so damaged the market for the Dr. Seuss folks to sell their books that it weighed against the finding of fair use. But transformative is a big win for the finding that this book is transformative, in quotes, is a big win for the authors who made this subsequent, like the Boldly Go version.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is a very interesting development, the play that you wrote. Matt, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I think you guys covered the analysis of the fair use really well. This brings me to my deep dislike of the continued and growing expansion of the copyright terms of years. The idea that – so the copyright theory as embodied in the Constitution is that we are trying to create incentives for inventors to create. The original copyright term was 28 years, and what we've seen is just a continual extension. So now it's the life plus 70 years, and I would not be surprised if we have a motion through Congress to push it further as Mickey Mouse comes up for to go under copyright. So the incentive for the creator, the author of these works that from 1957, they have been incentivized well enough, and we're looking at their heirs who are protecting, you know, their revenue stream and not the creator who's bringing these suits. I think that Justice Breyer, when the case came up almost 20 years ago, whether it was unconstitutional to extend the Copyright Act, I think his analysis of the market incentives for actually producing it is like you are getting like 0.001% of the revenue on average 120 years later or something like that. And I see no justification, on a public interest to extend copyright. And I really hope it doesn't go through in the next couple of years.
Right. Yeah, you raise a really good point, and it's a great segue to our next story, our next couple of stories, which deal with whether things are copyrightable or not. And you're underscoring, Matt, just how important it is to determine whether something is copyrightable or not, because if it is, it's copyrightable for an extraordinarily long term, and the damages for infringement are extraordinarily high. So it's a big deal answering these copyrightability questions. Some things are copyrightable, some things are not. One thing that we've always loved to ponder, whether it's copyrightable or not, is a tweet. Particular tweets, maybe some 140 character tweets are more original than others and would be entitled to copyrightability. Others might not. Is kind of how we've come down over the years. But of course, this week, all heck has broken loose on the internet as Twitter is testing out doubling the length of tweets. I am among the blessed cadre of people who they flip the switch and I can now tweet in 280 characters. I'm trying not to abuse that privilege because there's so much controversy about this. But I do find that that when I get cut off for tweets, it's because I'm trying to drop a link in and the link is too long. And it's nice to be able to drop those links in now and not have to worry about it. But I have found myself getting wordier than I have been in the past, and we'll have to watch that. But the copyright ramification is if it's longer, it may be more copyrightable. And there's a really interesting story. I think the author did not know that this flip had been switched or was about to be, switch had been flipped or was about to be. But a Pillsbury Winthrop lawyer wrote up a piece about a company called Framed Tweets. And this company is fascinating. For around $50, you can either put in your own tweet or they have a selection of famous tweets that you can have, you know, matted and framed and sent to you. And they would make quite lovely artwork as far as I'm concerned. So the reason that this lawyer decided to write it up is because of this question of copyrightability and also the right of publicity issue. A lot of the tweets that they make available are from famous people and they've become famous tweets. So to frame them and sell them impacts potentially use of these celebrities' rights of publicity. Their names are associated with the tweets when they're sold. So name and likeness is being used without their permission for commercial purposes. But I know, there we are. If you're watching the video, you're seeing a selection of them. And you can imagine why these, you know, when they put them in a nice frame, these might be fun to have on your wall. Or maybe you have friends' tweets or your own tweets that you'd want to frame. But of course, copyright comes into that. The author here, and I'm not quickly finding his name. I'm apologizing for not mentioning him by name, but he blogs at the Social Media and Games Law blog for Pillsbury Winthrop. He points out that at 140 characters, the character limit on Twitter limits the opportunity for tweets to obtain the level of originality required for copyright protection. At 280 characters, that limit is less stringent. And so I'm guessing things are more capable of being copyrighted, don't you think, Bill?
I think it definitely it negates to a certain extent the argument that he made about the, you know, how brief these are. But I think there's still limitations. I think he raises, I think the guy, I also found his name. It's Tim Rawson.
There we go.
Thank
you.
The attorney. I think he raises interesting points too about, you know, that copyright doesn't protect a recitation of facts. So, that's another limitation. I think the better angle of attack, which he gets to and that you got to, is a right of publicity claim that, you know, you're using someone's likeness, you're maybe using their name, you're certainly trying to, you're exploiting their name and likeness for commercial purposes. So I think that's a much more sort of on the nose way to deal with this if you were a celebrity whose tweets were taken without your permission and then sold. So I think you could get around all these complicated questions of copyright by just sort of hammering those points instead.
Right. But at some point, someone's going to have to tackle this issue of, I have a tweet and I'm asserting a copyright in it. And is that possible given that now it's only 280 characters long? Or maybe someone is exercising great restraint and sticking to the original game plan of 140 characters or somewhere in between. Matt, what do you think?
Yeah, I see it's difficult to get a copyright on something that short, but I see little reasoning to justify kicking it out for it being too short. The original case that extended originality was written by Chief Justice Holmes, and basically his analysis was that someone copying a lithograph, which is I don't exactly know enough about it to go into it, but essentially, like the mere change between color variations in what is mostly a copied picture created a copyright, because it was basically like something. The analysis was something like it was inherent in the nature of humanity to be able to be creative, and therefore the creativeness came out, and we're not going to look into it. That it wouldn't be original for me to say, you know, a short phrase or something like that under that analysis doesn't make sense. Now, on the other side, like, do we really want people to be able to stop, the use of such short phrases? And ultimately, is fair use going to come in to kick all of these out? So we might as well not give them. So I think it's a really interesting question, but I don't think, like, I got to imagine that haikus are copyrightable in those sort of short phrases. I like the, I wouldn't put one on my wall, but I like them. So
I think they're cool too. And I think the question of copyright and tweets continues to be interesting and was made more interesting this week by Twitter itself.
One more thing. Yes. I would really like someone to make a Chrome extension that just limited Twitter to 140 characters and allowed the people who wanted to keep it 140 characters, 140 characters. So if there's any great programmers out there, go for it.
Yes. Oh, so a self-imposed limit is what you're arguing for, because there are other extensions that let you go longer, or other third-party programs that let you go longer now. So, yep. I'm sure someone will come up with it. And if you only want to see 140 character tweets, that would be a great thing to be able to filter if you can tolerate sentences that end abruptly mid-thought, because that's what you'd have to live with. Yep. Speaking of things that can or cannot be copyrighted, Bill, you wrote an interesting piece on something we've been following, Carl Malamud and publicresource.org. There was an amicus brief filed in litigation that is testing the copyrightability of laws, original legal materials, regulations, etc. Can you tell us what's going on with Carl and publicresource.org these days and this brief?
Yeah, so it's a very interesting case, this one. It's dealing with what are called standards incorporated by reference. They're industry rules created by private industry groups that, it's standards for circuit breakers. It's all sorts of different things that industries create for themselves so that their products are interoperable and other reasons like that. Mm-hmm. Those are often incorporated eventually into federal regulations because it makes sense. You know, the industry workshopped these things and gotten to the point where they made sense, and then you use them as a blueprint to create federal regulations and federal laws. So the question here is whether or not the industry groups who created them in the first place, once they're incorporated into federal law, does the copyright that those private organizations held, is that still a valid copyright? Do they have the right to stop other people from reproducing those rules once they are the law of the land? Carl Malamud and publicresource.org very clearly said no, and they published a lot of these rules that were written by the American Society for Testing and Materials. They were sued over that, and a DC federal judge a few months ago ruled that the rules in question, even though the judge understood the policy concerns that, you know, this is the law of the land, the judge said these are under valid copyright, and that Congress would have acted to put them outside the realm of copyright law if they had wanted to. So this week, the interesting thing that happened was Zoe Lofgren and Daryl Issa, who two copyright skeptics, let's call it. They were big on stopping SOPA and PIPA a couple years ago when that all was going down. They filed a very interesting amicus brief supporting publicresource.org in its appeal of that ruling at the DC Circuit, saying that, you know, no one should be, quote, held liable for publishing the law of the land. And it had other really interesting sort of takes on this whole issue. So it was an interesting it's an interesting case to begin with. But now that you have lawmakers weighing in favor of this guy who's challenging these copyrights, it adds an interesting wrinkle.
It does. And thanks for updating us on what's going on there. We'll continue to watch that case and see where it goes. Final copyright issues for today involve the DMCA on a couple of different fronts. One is the intersection of the DMCA and NAFTA, and whether there will be any intersection between the DMCA and NAFTA. Apparently, we are learning from the various NAFTA proposal language that is out there that the notice and takedown provisions and safe harbor scheme, if you will, of the DMCA, safe harbor protections, may be absent from NAFTA. And there are lots of entertainment industry groups out there who would like the revision of NAFTA to leave this language out. Creative Future is a coalition of entertainment groups, and they say when it comes to NAFTA, the internet and tech groups want safe harbor provisions akin to those in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act that generally shields from liability for unauthorized copyrighted content posted on their sites as long as they promptly remove it upon notice. But they're questioning why these provisions should be in an updated NAFTA, undermining protections for American creatives overseas. Our communities rely on strong intellectual property protections, and in short, they would much prefer that NAFTA not mirror the DMCA. So this is something that is playing itself out. Presumably, representatives like Lofgren and Issa from California and others who like the way the DMCA operates will have something to say about this. But what the opponents say is they characterize the DMCA as subject of serious dispute at home, and they think that something like that should not be exported into a trade agreement. If they say it's subject to serious dispute, I suppose it must be because they're disputing it. but I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, and they're serious, but I don't know a whole lot of other people who are that upset about the DMCA, except that maybe it doesn't provide enough protection and certainty to the parties that it provides some measure of protection and certainty to. Now that I say this, I know that the entertainment industry has long railed against the DMCA and wishes that there was more that companies like Google and YouTube had to do when they, other than just receiving notices. They wish there was more of an active policing duty on folks hosting online content. So with NAFTA, it will be interesting to see whether that impetus makes its way into the revision. What do you think, Bill?
This came up with the TPP a few years ago, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was another trade deal like NAFTA. And I think the fact that it keeps coming up is testament to how polarizing the DMCA is. That, you know, it, especially coming from the reporter perspective here, you reach out to these two camps on the DMCA, and you would think that you were talking about two completely different things. I mean, when you reach out to the folks in Silicon Valley, it is the most important. That the internet would collapse without it, that it's mm-hmm. what's allowed the internet to grow into what it is. You reach out to the folks at Hollywood, and it's allowing YouTube to profit from piracy and to hide behind all these different things. So the language is often very hyperbolic from both sides when it comes to the DMCA. And we've seen litigation over the years. I don't know if you guys remember this, but a couple of years ago, there was that whole situation where it was a state attorney general was subpoenaing Google for documents related to its responses to various takedowns and things like that. And it later came out that the MPAA's attorneys had heavily lobbied him to investigate Google in this way. So it is a very contentious thing for these two industries, and it all comes down to who bears the burden to police piracy on the internet. And mm-hmm. the DMCA puts it pretty heavily on Hollywood, and they hate it. But I think the fact that it keeps coming up in the context of these trade agreements really is a sign of just how much these two camps really get fired up by this issue.
So maybe we should try and think through how this will play out practically if we continue to have the DMCA in the United States, as it appears that we will, but it doesn't make its way into the revised version of NAFTA. How will that look? How will that impact people?
Matt, did you want to go?
No, go ahead.
Okay. I think it's more of a more than real sort of real life effects. I think it's more of this proxy battle of trying to push the chains a little bit in either direction. I don't know exactly what would happen if I'm not certain, but I believe that Canada has a similar system of ISP safe harbors that the DMCA provides. I'm not certain about Mexico. I can't imagine it would have a huge practical effect day to day, but I think it is this sort of if you're Hollywood, you don't want to normalize this system that you hate. So you don't want to incorporate it into things that we're then, that we're imposing on other countries. I think that's more the issue than the practical day to day.
Right. Matt, can you envision, suppose you're someone in Canada or Mexico, and I suppose NAFTA would have some application to you if you were a creative person there and you wanted to enforce your rights against someone in one of the other parties to NAFTA, whether or not you had a notice and takedown regime might be governed by NAFTA as opposed to U.S. law if the people were not in the U.S., so you're in Canada and you want to enforce against someone in Mexico, say. That's how I see it coming up.
Yeah, okay. So if I was in the U.S. and we posted a treaty that said there was no longer there was no longer a DMCA, then in effect, into U.S. law, I don't know how this would happen in Canada and Mexico, but if it was in U.S. law, then that would mean that the DMCA would be done, which means the effect of not having the DMCA is that you can sue a third party. So you can – so instead of suing me, who posted your Star Trek video, who is in law school, doesn't have any money, and you're and it's hard to find – you're going to be able to sue Google for them not stopping me. So on a practical effect, this just gives content creators just incredible leverage to change the practices of companies like Google to go out and stop people from posting videos. Like, YouTube would not act the way it does if it was liable for every video that came up there. We wouldn't be having these fair use questions, because those, the digital content would probably be a lot better, and the error rate would be on taking things off, instead of the error rate now is to leave things up. To know the effect of what the proposed NAFTA agreement would have to know what the underlying law is in Mexico and Canada, and I'm just not sure what it is right now.
But to be clear, I was under the impression, at least, that what was happening here was that the draft language wouldn't require a similar notice and takedown system of other countries. I don't think it's on the table that we would pass a NAFTA agreement would be a backdoor repeal of the DMCA. I think that's a much more.
I was just using that as a hypothetical, as its effect. Like, if you put in a treaty, what happens in the United States is that the treaty becomes law. But no, there's no provision for that. But if there isn't a DMCA like regime in Canada, the question is. The analysis is that by putting it in the treaty, that would make it law in Canada if it happened the same way as it does in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going to be fascinating to see what happens here and what the fallout is. Obviously, there are arguments on both sides of the DMCA. And as Creative Future has pointed out, the parties on either side are very serious about their positions and they dispute one another. As someone who seems to like the DMCA as a model is Dean Baker. He's an economist with an op-ed at truthout.org. And he proposes the DMCA as a model that we should be thinking and our lawmakers should be thinking about applying to the problem of fake news and fake accounts. And this has been all over the news this week as more and more information comes out from Facebook and Twitter about accounts that they have flagged as having been illicit accounts used to manipulate fake news stories getting into people's media diets during the election. The approach that Dean Baker thinks that we should take is to have a DMCA-like approach where there would be a notice, and if something is considered to be fake news, the intermediary like Twitter or Facebook would have to take it down, and then someone could make a counter argument that President Obama does want to remove the Pledge of Allegiance from schools. This was a real fake news story that I saw during the election, and they could make their case that the news was not fake, and you could go back and forth about it. But then there would, be fines and teeth that would help this stuff stay off while protecting the third-party intermediaries from liability and allowing the free flow of information. I think it's an interesting idea. What do you think, Bill?
I found it pretty problematic, maybe troubling.
Yeah.
It raises, news and the veracity of news is so completely different than the idea of an intellectual property regime. One is a you know, there are all sorts of gray areas when it comes to copyright. There's fair use. There's all sorts of things that complicate the picture. But it's a right that you have. Mm-hmm. When it comes to applying a system like DMCA takedown to fake news, what are the standards? What are the thresholds for how you determine what's a story, what's opinion, what's news, what's true in my mind that's not true in your mind? I think it's empowering at its best. It's burdening the ISPs in a way that they would then take shortcuts and censor people. And mm-hmm. at worst, it's empowering ISPs to do all sorts of censorship. It seems like an absolutely awful idea to me. I'm the first person to tell you that the problem of fake news is a huge one, but I don't think this is anywhere near the right way to do it.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, and I think it's a really good point. I do think that there would be some categories of stories that are pretty immediately verifiable or not, like the one that I tossed out as an example. But you do rapidly get out from that verifiable universe to things that are more gray and difficult to quantify. Certainly, if a regime like this were to go into place, you'd need some sort of source that would be the definitive voice on what was fake and what was not. And so, you know, who's that going to be? Matt, what do you think?
That certainly is not going to be me. I agree entirely with Bill. I think that this would be a terrible, terrible system. And I think that the best analogy is that Colorado has campaign finance laws, which are imposed, that are implemented by citizens who act as private attorney generals. And so what you tend to see, especially like in the political context, which is kind of what we're talking about, I think that this would implicate far more than the political context. But what tends to happen is that opposing parties on the right and the left, and they're both bad about this, is that they bring suits of action to enforce the campaign finance rules, which is just to curtail the other side's ability to speak. Mm-hmm. So I could see in a heated political debate that you're going to file a DMCA on almost everything that comes out against your candidate, and you'll deal with the mm-hmm. consequences later because you're going to be the president. And so the incentives to act maliciously by using the system to curtail speech, I think that are far better than the gains that you get from more truth. And also, like, when you step outside of the gray line of, like, is this close to true or is this not close to true, when you step into things like when Donald Trump was saying that Barack Obama wasn't a citizen or something like that, like – so there, you know, people believe that, but like it's so outside of like the realm of truth that the people who believe that, like, I'm not sure that you can help them with a truth campaign like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the further you step away into falsehood, the like you're not going to be able to, like, your goal is to get these people to believe the truth, and they're probably not going to believe it anyways, even if you only give them true news.
Maybe your goal is just to make sure the information is as accurate as it can be, and you can leave people to their own belief systems and not have to worry too much about that. If you know you've done as good a job you can as far as the accuracy goes. We're certainly not going to resolve that issue on this show, but I thought it was an interesting idea and using the DMCA as a model for legislating in other areas. Bill Donahue, it has been wonderful to have you. I know you need to run. Can't thank you enough for joining us today on This Week in Law. Bill Donahue, senior reporter at Law 360. And are you also on the Pro Se podcast over there with Amber McKinney?
I am. That's right. We release a new episode every Saturday. And we are a half hour quick recap of the biggest stories and the little hidden gems from the last week that Law 360 covered. So it's a good show, and I would encourage everyone to, we can find us on iTunes, Google Play, anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Wonderful. We'll definitely be doing that. So glad you could join us today. Matt and I are going to stay on and do a couple more stories in our concluding material, but we wanted to bid you a fond farewell, Bill. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. It was great.
Thank you, Bill. And I want to tell you as well, the Pro Se name is fantastic.
It is.
Thank you, Matt. I appreciate that.
P-R-O-S-A-Y is the name of their podcast. Yes. Take care, Bill.
Pun.
Great having you.
Great. Bye-bye.
All right. So we have a couple more stories to get to before we wrap up the show, but we're going to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is Felix Gray. This is one of my favorite sponsors we've ever had on the show. I am rocking some Felix Grays right now. And what they do is reduce the strain on your eyes from gazing at screens. And Lord knows I gaze at way too many screens. I'm sure that you all do too. These are designed to cut the blue light that emits from computer and phone and tablet screens. I'm finding that they're just, and again, they're designed to reduce glare from screens and keep your eyes from getting tired. You know, our eyes were just not made to stare at screens all day. So you're going to want to do something to give your eyes some relief. You get dry eyes, you get migraines, perhaps blurry vision. These are just a few things that could happen when you strain your eyes like that. I know, again, I don't want to get too far down the road of what optometrists and ophthalmologists do, but in my son's case, he doesn't need reading glasses, but his doctor is having him wear them to reduce the strain on his eyes now when he's reading so that it helps him with vision problems later on in life. My husband is very nearsighted and the fear is my son could become that way too. But by reducing the strain on his eyes now, hopefully that will help with that situation. So it's never good to have strain on your eyes. And Felix Gray lenses are specially designed to filter blue light and eliminate glare from screens, which are the two main culprits behind digital eye strain. Their glasses have blue light filtering technology embedded into the lens, so they remain effective without the telltale yellow tint or color or distortion of other blue light filtering glasses. And their frames are really, really cool. I am wearing the, I've got Touring on today. This is how much I like these glasses. Felix Gray sent me a pair on their own dime so that I could talk about them on the show. I like them so much, I've got myself another pair in another style. So this is the Touring style. My other pair you've seen me wear are Faraday's. Like them so much, my husband tried them out. He needed a pair. We got him a pair. And these are my go-to holiday gift for my really, really good friends who, like me, are of a certain age and already have, you know, eye and reading issues. And these really help. And if you do use readers for things, they're not available in prescription for prescription glasses yet. But if you're just someone who needs readers from time to time, you can order the Felix Grays with magnification. So the ones I have on today have a very light amount, 0.25 of magnification, which I find is just perfect for sitting a few feet away, a couple feet away from a computer screen. Great for my phone screen too, since I already have my phone screen set at a huge font. So with these on, I can read my phone just fine and I'm cutting the glare. It's all good. So I'm definitely doling these out to my favorite people in the world come the holidays. And hopefully you'll be motivated to try them out soon. Available in non-prescription and reading lenses. Prescription glasses are coming soon, so wait for that. You can get magnification from 1.0 to 2.5, or you can go with that 0.25 very light magnification, which is really nice. Even if you don't need readers, it really just helps your eyes as you're looking at the screen. Again, it's why my son wears reading glasses and doesn't need them technically to just reduce that strain on his eyes. So they do have great frames. Faraday and Turing are two of them. I think they're on this theme of naming frames after famously geeky people. So if you're a geek, you'll appreciate all of that geek history involved. And you'll appreciate they have different frames for different sized faces. And you can, you know, there's absolutely nothing to lose by shipping yourself a few pairs that you think might work for you. They do let you know this is good for a small face, this is good for a larger face. So you can kind of narrow it down that way. All orders include free shipping and free returns. So try out a few, keep the ones you like, try out different magnifications too, and see what works best for you. So when you do try them out, you're going to head on over to felixgrayglasses.com/twill. That will let them know that you learned about them from us, which we would greatly appreciate. You're going to discover a smarter way to work. Thanks so much, Felix Gray Glasses, for your support. FelixGrayGlasses.com/twill. Matt, we're going to have to get you a pair of these at some point in time for your law school life. Do you wear readers or no?
I am blind, so I actually have a prescription. So when they get prescription ones, I am all in. Because I don't, I have funny shaped eyes, so the contacts don't work out.
Oh, that's too bad. All right, we've got just a bit more material to go through before we wrap up the show today. We have a terms of service story I wanted to hit before we get to our concluding materials for the show. So this is a quickie. If you're an Echo show owner, you might have noticed in the last week, if you're someone who, for example, might have liked to watch This Week in Law on your Echo show, what you might have been asking was, let's play This Week in Law on YouTube. You can't do that anymore. Apparently, Amazon and Google are in a spat about compatibility of whatever ESL is using to access YouTube. This is not the first time this has happened. Other platforms, apps, including Roku and Windows Phone, have found themselves blocked by YouTube. And here, Google has actually come out and said they are violating our terms of service. They haven't said exactly how. But over at Ars Technica, they point out that in these other instances where this happened, there were issues, for example, about ads being omitted. And now I can't test it out, right? Now I can't ask Alexa to play the show and see if our ad, you know, we don't have YouTube ads, so this one wouldn't be a good example. But if other shows or other YouTube programming were having their ads omitted on the Echo show, something like that seems to be at the root of the problem. And hopefully Amazon and Google will work this out, because obviously it benefits everyone to have the world's biggest and most popular video platform available to what is rapidly becoming the world's most popular personal assistant, or may already be that. Matt, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, that these are giant corporate games which are being played. I'm sure that, you know, terms of service and these sorts of things, when you're putting your content on, you know, different browsers or different extensions, like these probably get broken all the time. This seems like you're beating me at the home device system, and I'm kind of taking out on you. So I think it hurts consumers, and it's kind of sad. But I don't know the backstory. That's just how it plays.
Right. And Victor corrected me. Apparently, we do have YouTube ads when we put our programming on YouTube. I'd forgotten about that. But we do, another little just plug for the network is we do have something that you can use on the Echo for your flash briefing, and it rotates through different programming on the network. So if you're using that flash briefing feature of your Echo, whether it's the show or any Echo, Twit does have a great flash briefing skill that I love to use every day, along with the rest of the stuff in my flash briefing. Let's move on. I want to get right to our animal selfie of the week, which may be my very favorite animal selfie we've ever received. It is our very first fan-made animal selfie. It comes to us from Joe. I'll go ahead and let it play for you, and we'll talk about it afterwards. Well, we have to do our bumper, too. All right. Joe created an animal selfie for us, so let's see it in all its glory. Ah, it's a sandhill crane. And if you can see, it's also a garden gnome.
Yes.
And the garden gnome had a twill sign and unfortunately did not remain standing very long. Here's what Joe wrote when he set this in. These sandhill cranes live in the Tampa Bay area. There are various myths involving cranes, and in Chinese mythology, cranes are generally symbolically connected with the idea of immortality. And then the gnomes are regarded as good luck charms in one's house and garden. For those folks living in rural areas, you'd often find gnomes living in the rafters of barns where they'd be keeping a watchful eye on the owner's animals, crops, and garden produce. This gnome is a classic E. Griebel 1950 to 1960 model, West German, and has been indulging in the This Week in Law drinking game. That would explain his toppling over in front of the sandhill crane. Joe also wrote, thanks for all you do. And yes, I think your podcast will be immortal, like the mythological connotation of the sandhill crane. Wish you luck. And then he wrote 73 and put best regards in quotes, which caused me to have to look up that 73 is best regards in 92 code, which was adopted by Western Union in 1859 to reduce bandwidth usage over telegraph lines. So, Joe, this is just so delightful. My profuse apologies. This was sent to me over the summer, and there was a point in time over the summer where I was offline for more than 8 days, and getting all of the emails that came in while I was gone and sorting through them and making sure that I'd addressed all of them was a challenge. And I, when I went back through and looked for, oh, you know, what animal selfie suggestions have people sent me recently in trying to prep for today's show, this popped up as one that had come in all that time ago, and I hadn't really paid sufficient attention to. So apologies, Joe, for the delay, but thank you so much. We love your animal selfie of the week. From the copyright standpoint, I'm not sure who was filming there. We were way down in the grass. I assume that the copyright is with Joe on this one, unless there was a trap camera set up that was meant to capture wayward gnomes and sandhill cranes, at which point we may have more of a discussion about who owns the copyright in something that was not specifically photographed by a photographer. Matt, anything to add?
Well, there may be some gnome organization that really wants the gnome to have the copyright, and hopefully yes, the Ninth Circuit can get to that answer someday.
Maybe so, maybe so. Our resource of the week is a great one. Mary Hodder clued me into this. She's been on the show before. And it's something that you should definitely check out if this kind of thing is of interest to you. It is optoutprescreen.com is the URL. It is the official place that all of the consumer credit reporting companies use to see if someone has wanted to opt out temporarily. You may do that for 5 years, or permanently. You can do that if you mail in a form. Your name will not be provided by the credit reporting agencies to creditors or insurance companies to make you firm offers of credit or insurance. So if you've ever gotten those unsolicited offers for a credit card or insurance, it's because the three credit reporting agencies are sharing your data with those companies, and they are sending you what presumably is junk mail, unless you're dying for credit and insurance. And you can opt out and make sure that you don't get that mail. So if you go to optoutprescreen.com, that's the place to do it. They, of course, give you a whole spiel about what are the benefits of receiving firm offers. If you're interested in knowing why you might want to receive this junk mail, you can read what they have to say about it. What Mary had to say about it was a great idea. Don't just do it for yourself or your spouse or your parents, but think about your kids. You know, you can maybe prevent them from ever receiving this kind of mail if you go ahead and permanently opt them out. What a nice gift, I would suggest. Yeah, I'm going to definitely get on that. So that's our resource of the week. Our tips of the week are twofold. One of them is about we talked about robots becoming molecular. This is kind of along those lines. AI now wants to tell you what to eat. AI is getting into various areas of our lives. There is an app called Askin Diet that is applying artificial intelligence to provide you with nutritional advice and insights uniquely tailored to each user. They have a feature in beta right now where all you have to do is snap a picture of your meal, and the app parses what's on the plate and tries to log the meal, tries to guess exactly what you're having, and then it'll give you nutritional information. The app identifies the items in the picture, and you're supposed to confirm the items and log it all at once. I really think it would be entertaining to find out what it thinks is on your plate and how accurate it is. I haven't tried it out myself, but this is just something that popped up to me as interesting. Also interesting, we got some user mail pointing out, we called last week's episode advocacy. And I heard back from the law student at Hastings, who is the editor of their business law journal there. And he pointed out that one of our sponsors here at the TWiT Network, Qualcomm, is sort of in the same boat as VidAngel. Now, Qualcomm doesn't seem to be doing this because they are trying to sway anybody in litigation. But we talked about VidAngel doing advocacy with its video, saying how great it is to be able to filter your movies, which is what its service does. But that if you're anywhere in Southern California, you've probably seen Qualcomm's billboards, and if you at all watch cable news, you've probably seen their ads that their pitch is, we're the reason you love your smartphone, which seems like another kind of advocacy. They want you to definitely have this impression that, you know, what their contribution is to your smartphone is something that makes it critical to the phone's function, and all those experiences that you've had wouldn't be possible without it. So they somehow want to have your goodwill toward your phone-related experiences not leave out the fact that Qualcomm is involved in those experiences. So we had a back and forth an email about advocacy, you know, maybe becoming more of a trend with corporations, which is really interesting for the corporate speech doctrine, which again is interesting in light of what's going on with the NFL these days. So lots of shifts over the years in what, you know, to what extent the First Amendment protects corporate speech. And as more and more companies are taking their message straight to their intended audience rather than relying on traditional media channels or things like television advertising, I think that we might see some shifts in how the corporate speech doctrine evolves. So our tip is just keep an eye out for that trend of advocacy by corporations, and send us examples if you see more of what we're talking about. We think it's going to be interesting. Matt, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, and just that the the Qualcomm Apple dispute. I'm not sure if it played a role in when they started rolling out advertising, but it seems like that one's going to go to the mat over some patent disputes, and there's lots and lots of money involved, and I'm sure we'll cover it in the months and years to come.
I'm sure we will. We need a second MCLE passphrase for the show before we get out of here. So the second one is going to harken back to our discussion of the New York play that had the fair use doctrine applied to it by a court. And it's going to be naughty Cindy Lou Who. Oh, sorry to do that to you. make you have that visual. But that is our phrase, our second phrase for the show. And with that, we'll go ahead and wrap up this episode of This Week in Law. Matt Curtis, pleasure chatting with you as always.
Yeah, great to talk to you too. And anyone in the really the Midwest, I invite you to come tomorrow to Notre Dame. It's going to be a real treat to have the slants here. They will be at the Eck Hall of Law courtroom at noon. It is an open invitation. I know that we've got a game day tomorrow, so it should be a packed house. But it's going to be a real pleasure. And if you don't have a chance, go back. I'm not sure which episode it was, but we had Simon on over the summer, and he is he was just a class act character. And the real impact of going through a litigation to an individual is substantial, and that he fought for free speech rights is just incredible. So I'm really excited to meet him in person.
Yeah, I'm so excited for you, and I can't wait to talk to you next week and see how the concert was. I don't want to encourage you to do any copyright violative activities, but it sure would be fun to see some video of it. So I'll just drop that in there and leave it at that. We'll definitely be back and get your review of the whole event next week when hopefully Mike Curtis will be back. Mike Keys will be back with us as well. I'm going to get you guys related, like it or not. And we'll certainly be here. We record the show every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. Victor in the studio is definitely echoing. He wants pictures from the event, Matt, so we can definitely get a feel for how it all went. We'll be back next week. We hope you can be back next week too. We certainly love it when you can join us live, but don't worry if you can't, just head on over to twit.tv/twill. Our entire archive of shows is there for your consumption at your leisure on your device of choice. And what else can I tell you? We'd love it, love it, love it if you'd get in touch with us between the shows, as lots of people have done to contribute to this week's show. I am Denise at twit.tv. Matt is Matt C at twit.tv. Hit us up by email or on Twitter. Whether you do it in 140 characters or 280, I'm going to welcome it either way. what else should I let you know? Facebook page. We definitely have that going on. Funny comment over on our Facebook page over the last week had to do with our story this today about piracy and Star Trek Discovery. Ben D over there on our Facebook page just quipped, demographic overlap perhaps between people prone to pirate and people who might be Star Trek fans. There might be a little bit, Ben.
Maybe
just a tiny bit. So I do post things up to Facebook all week long as we're getting ready for the shows. We also have this Flipboard magazine where we post all the stories that we're going to have in the show. If you want to post things to that too, shoot me an email and we'll definitely take your suggestions into account. That's at flipboard.com/dhowell. This Week in Law is one of the magazines I maintain over there, or our discussion points for each show are at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. So glad you could join us this week, and we hope to see you next time on This Week in Law. Take care.